Welcome to the Falk Salem Podcast. Each month we'll bring you a mix of operational announcements and clinical pieces to keep you up to speed. Through our monthly podcasts, our goal is to put the tools and education right in the palm of your hand. By keeping you up to date, we hope that we can empower you to continue bringing exceptional medical care to the city of Salem and beyond. Any and all material we release has been edited to comply with HIPAA standards.
Happy holidays, everyone. Season's greetings, and thank you for joining us for the December 2020 podcast. My name is Cole. I'm a paramedic with Falk Ambulance here in Salem, and here's the outline for this month's podcast. Our first piece is from Dustin, focusing on trauma system guidelines, breaking down those guidelines into trauma activations. And it also includes an interview with the trauma system coordinator of Salem Hospital. Next, we have a focus piece discussing a common prescription medication called lisinopril and an additive medication called hydrochlorothiazide. After which, we have our employee spotlight. Corey Reynolds has agreed to give us some insight on what it's like being an EMT with Falk, who's also going through paramedic school during COVID. Lastly, we have a piece tying back into our trauma system guidelines discussing the clotting cascade, permissive hypotension, and the use of saline in trauma therapy.
Greetings, team. It's Bill. I wanted to hop on the podcast this month to share a brief operational update and quick message of hope as we approach the end of the year. As you may have seen, Cole and I are going to be hosting a set of vaccine and COVID info town halls where we just kind of wanted to talk about all things that we know about the vaccine so far, COVID info, PPE, kind of our operational plan moving forward, and how we're going to handle things based on the information we have in front of us at this time, which is changing rapidly. And we're working our best to stay at the table and provide information as we get it. So the other thing I want to talk about was just to say it's hard not to be hopeless right now. There's two people dying a minute. We've got 300,000 people dead in the U.S. And we've got three hard months ahead, you guys. And I know you're tired. I know everyone is exhausted with this whole thing. I'm ready just to go to a movie again or go to a restaurant or go to the grocery store without a mask. And I know you are too. But we need to remember there are still some reasons to have hope and to be hopeful and to celebrate this year, despite everything that's happened. Nationwide, we've lost five Falk employees, EMTs, and paramedics that do the job you guys do because of COVID. But at our operation, we haven't lost anyone, and I am just so thankful for that. That is something that gives me hope. We got the new CBA in place. There's a raise structure that promises raises for the employees over the next several years, and I think it worked out as a win-win. I think that's a good thing, and we need to celebrate that. We have a new contract with the city, and that gives us a financial foundation to better weather challenges like COVID and other things that happen to a volume-based business. And that will put us in a position where we can reinvest in the business. We've already purchased 20 brand new Toughbooks that we anticipate will be here hopefully in the next 30 days ready to use. We know that's been a big issue, but changing the contract with the city allows us to do those things, and it's a big thing to celebrate. We've got new relationships with Marion County. We've got George leading the charge to vaccinate the community against the flu, to get the community tested for COVID, and now he'll help us lead the charge to get the community vaccinated for COVID, and that's going to be important because that's our way out. One of the last things I'm hopeful for, guys, is the vaccine. We're probably going to have to sacrifice another holiday because of all this, because it's dangerous and we don't want to hurt anyone that we love. But the bottom line is that the vaccine is going to provide us a way out of this. It may take us a year to get it out to everyone in Oregon that wants it, and it may take longer for us to manage our way out of the outbreak. But the bottom line is that's a big reason for us to see the light at the end of the tunnel. And I think it's important that we have hope as much as we can. The last thing I wanted to say, guys, as we approach the holidays is just thank you. Thanks for the job you do. Thanks for getting up every day and coming in and fighting the good fight, because it's a weird and wonderful job, and not just anybody can do it. I am so proud of our team, and something I've told people since I joined EMS in 1997 is I get to work around the best people I know, and that's still true to this day. Thanks for what you do. Stay safe out there. Wear your mask when you can. Wash your hands. Practice social distancing. I know you're sick of hearing all this stuff. Think seriously about getting vaccinated. And remember, as long as we have hope, we can stand and fight because it matters. I'm extremely proud of you guys, and I'm thankful to be part of your team and to get to work for you. If you need anything, please contact me, and thanks for listening.
Here are some general announcements for December 2020. First off, if you live in the Salem, Oregon area and happen to catch our podcast, remember that we have access to COVID testing events that happen as part of Marion County and even as part of the Oregon Health Authority State COVID Testing Group. These are happening on Mondays and they're happening on Wednesdays at the state fairgrounds here in Marion County in the city of Salem. Do a quick Google search, check out the information on that. This is for free drive-through COVID testing. You can drive through, test your whole family in the event. The only thing that they ask is that you pre-register online before you do it. And you're gonna see Falk there. We're working in partnership with both Oregon Health Authority and with Marion County, and we are doing that COVID testing side by side with the agents from the county. The next announcement that I have is I would like to say welcome to three new employees who have gone through NEOP and are now tackling their FTEP phases out into the field. Victor, Michaela, and Jonah have all joined the team, and I look forward to seeing them do great things here in the future. That being said, we are still hiring. Search for us on the web. Look us up by looking up Falk Northwest and throw in an application. We have great benefits, competitive wages, and a fast-paced progressive system. We'd love to have you with us, see if we're your particular cup of tea. And finally, I want to say a big giant thank you to all of the listeners here for the Falk Salem podcast. Without you, I'm basically just talking into a microphone and watching things record on a computer. I'm hoping that through this podcast, you've found some benefit and you've found some desire to challenge yourself to be a better medic, or challenge yourself to be a better practitioner, or challenge yourself just to be a more empathetic human being. No doubt this year has been hell for anybody in healthcare, and even for those who are not in healthcare. Everyone has suffered more than their share with COVID and with all the challenges that we faced. And those challenges aren't over. But we have all been very successful, and together we are pulling through that despite all of our differences, and we're moving forward, and the end might just be around the next corner. So I, for one, am ready to welcome 2021 with open arms and with a hope in my heart that, you know, perhaps this dark forest, perhaps whatever this adventure is starting to come to a close. And we can put this behind us and learn from this and use this to build better, stronger relationships with, you know, each other here in the time to come. So again, thank you so much for, you know, taking the time to listen to this podcast and to, you know, digest this information and do with it what you will. I truly wish the very best to you and your family this holiday season, and I am so incredibly proud of how the United States, and I guess even the worldwide healthcare network, has banded together and come together to support one another through this nightmare that is COVID. It has been one of the single most difficult times in my entire career, spanning from 2001 up and until now. I have never dealt with anything like this in the entirety of my career, and yet, despite all of that adversity, the brotherhood and sisterhood and the commonality and just the camaraderie that is there between healthcare right now, together we are all standing against this tidal wave, and together we are still responding out into the night, and we are still working with patients that are infectious. And we're still towing the line, and we're still out there supporting you and being there for you and your family in the midst of all of this crisis. So Thank you so much, healthcare providers, for everything that you have been doing. Thank you so much, EMTs and paramedics and firefighters and police officers, you know, all of the hospital staff, all the support staff who make the hospitals run and clean and allow us to even have that environment to bring patients to. You know, everyone on this team has been integral and absolutely positively priceless and has helped us all to be successful. So here's to you in the 2021 season, and I wish you all the very, very best.
Imagine you are talking to someone about a career in EMS. One of the first things that person wants to know about is trauma. It's a fascinating and awful topic that people think about when anything EMS related gets brought up in conversation. GSWs, stabs, MVAs, all the blood, how could someone comprehend all the chaos on a scene like that? Well, a special breed of people who thrive on the craziness are able to maintain a level head and know exactly what to do and to help whoever needs it. This is our very own EMS professionals. Falk has a guideline when it comes to trauma that will raise suspicion and provide care and get the patient to a trauma facility. Fortunately for us, here in Salem, we transport to only one hospital, and that hospital is a level 2 trauma facility. This means Salem Hospital has 24-hour immediate coverage by general surgeons, orthopedic surgery, neurosurgery, anesthesiology, emergency medicine, radiology, and critical care. This comes as a huge benefit to our patients, but now we have to recognize the need for all these resources. This is where the guideline comes into play. I have Cole here to run you through our trauma system guideline.
So in our protocols here that were released in 2020, the trauma system guidelines haven't seen much of a change from the previous versions in 2019. Going down this list is a flowchart of different types of criteria and prompts that are hoping that we will look at these and apply these towards our patient to help us identify the most sick and the most distressed individuals, the ones who may be quickly deteriorating and the ones who need to be triaged to be seen first and prioritized once we get to the emergency room. So the trauma system guidelines are divided up into different sections. The first section are mandatory physiological criteria that we need to see on this patient. The next set of criteria are mandatory anatomical criteria, or things that we would anatomically see or recognize that tell us that the patient has undergone some major event or some sort of major energy transfer and might have serious injuries. Next, we have a section about mechanism of injury, a section that really just refers to high energy transfers towards a patient and giving us clues on how those situations might severely injure that patient and looking for signs that the patient has gone through those sorts of mechanisms that lead to significant injury. And then finally, the last section here really talks about special populations and special situations that we might run into that severely affect patients that have suffered a traumatic injury. So going back to that first section here, mandatory physiological criteria, we're looking for anybody who has a GCS less than 13 or a systolic blood pressure less than 90 or a respiratory rate that's less than 10, that's one breath every 6 seconds, or greater than 29. So we're thinking about that patient who's working hard to breathe or has respiratory depression. And if we break that all down and boil it all down, that's really trying to show that this person physiologically is in a compensated or even a decompensating sort of a situation. So in the presence of trauma with someone who has a depressed GCS, we need to be really cautious that patient doesn't have a head injury. Or if that patient in the presence of trauma has a low blood pressure, that patient may already be compensating or even on the borderline of decompensating with their vital signs and they may be slipping away from us. Or in the presence of trauma, that patient that's working really hard to breathe, one breath every 2 seconds, or a patient who has severe respiratory depression. What that's really trying to tell us here is that is a critical patient. That patient needs rapid transport to an appropriate trauma center where they can rule out the reasons for why they're having those physiologic criteria. And moving on down here towards mandatory anatomical criteria, any and all penetrating injuries to the head, the neck, the torso, or extremities proximal to the elbow or proximal to the knee. So if we have penetrating injuries, obviously to the head and the neck and the torso, we can injure a lot of stuff on the inside. But extremities proximal to the elbow and the knee, this is where we have a lot of major blood vessels that come into close proximity with one another and actually get close to the surface of the skin. So penetrating injuries to the elbow and penetrating injuries to the knee, they can actually bleed really, really significantly, and they're also really hard to compress. We're almost always going to a tourniquet if we have an arterial bleed or a significant venous bleed in that area. Moving on here, if we have somebody who has a flail chest, a couple of ribs that are broken in more than one place, you end up getting that paradoxical movement of the chest, so the flail segment where I breathe in and that section actually sucks in rather than expands out with my chest. I breathe back out and that section actually pops back out while the rest of my chest wall sucks back in. Like, that's going to be a completely disconnected joint of your rib cage there. Two or more proximal long bone fractures, a crushed, degloved, or mangled extremity, because a lot can be done to save that person's mangled extremity. They may not immediately be at risk to their life, but it's at risk to their limb, which significantly impacts the quality of their life that they're going to have from this point on. Amputation proximal to the wrist and the ankles, suspected pelvic fractures, because you have lots of blood vessels that are going through that area. At least six major feeder vessels all come into a major confluence there of arteries and veins as it goes through your pelvis. Open or depressed skull fractures, and then any limb in the presence of trauma that has motor or sensory deficit. So this is going to be that patient that might have dislocated their, let's say they've dislocated their arm. Now that patient has sudden complete loss of sensation to that arm. It may be that we have a pinched nerve and that nerve is being impacted and it needs to be released. It also could be that we've pinched the blood vessel to that area and that whole area is infarcting. That whole affected extremity is now infarcting because we've basically put on a tourniquet on that area. They got caught in the wrong place and we may have a problem there. Those are all anatomical criteria that are telling us in the presence of trauma that these patients need to be recognized as unstable. We need to transport them rapidly to a hospital so that interventions can be made in regards to those signs that we're seeing on these patients. Looking at, the trauma system guidelines from the form of mechanism of injury, adults that have fallen greater than 20 feet. Now, one story, we're equaling roughly 10 feet. So this is going to be an adult that is falling from that second story building or above, right? We're going to consider that a significant mechanism of injury. Or children falling greater than 10 feet. But another way to think about this is a child falling 2 to 3 times the actual height of the individual. So we start thinking about the height of, maybe a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old. If they fall off the bed, okay, that's about equal to maybe 1.5, times the height of that kid. But a kid like that falls off the roof, that's 10 feet easy that patient's coming down. Guarantee that, that's going to be a significant fall in comparison to the adult that falls off the roof in that same height. So looking more at mechanisms of injury here, high-risk auto crash signs here that are mechanisms of injury. If we're looking at a wrecked car and we have intrusion into the vehicle greater than 12 inches on the side of an occupant or 18 inches on any other site on the vehicle, right? That means that despite crumple points and despite areas where these vehicles are designed to kind of crumple in and absorb and transfer that energy around the frame versus transferring it to the patient, if I have intrusion that's on my side of the vehicle 12 inches in, most likely those energies got transferred directly to my body, directly to my torso, directly to my bone structure, directly into my solid organs. And this is going to be a really big sign we need to be suspicious that a patient might have internal injuries. Or 18 inches on any side of the vehicle, meaning that it was a high-speed auto crash and a whole lot of force was transferred through that occupant compartment, possibly through our patient as well. Thinking again about auto crashes, any partial or complete ejection from the automobile needs to be considered a high risk, high likelihood of potential significant injury of a patient. You get separated from a vehicle, flung from it, or even partially flung from the vehicle. We have to be really suspicious about that. If there's a death in the same passenger compartment and somebody else survived and the other one died, that's what that's trying to say. You know, the driver died, but the passenger is alive. The driver died and they went through that energy transfer. The passenger went through the same energy transfer here. And somehow they're still alive. We need to be really suspicious that this patient is injured and we need to take them quickly to a trauma center. And then vehicle telemetry data consistent with a high risk of injury. This is something like OnStar, something like that, that's giving us vehicle telemetry saying that, the vehicle was detected to be traveling at a high rate of speed and then has crashed. Any auto versus pedestrian or an auto versus a bicyclist, when the bicyclist is thrown or separated from their bike, if the pedestrian or the bicyclist is run over, has any sort of impact with the vehicle that's considered to be over 20 miles an hour, I mean, that's kind of a no-brainer. Car versus person, car wins. I mean, even if it's a low roll or a slow roll, it can easily push people into a much more complex kind of an accident, falling and being separated from the bicycle by chance. You know, and then motorcycles or ATV crashes greater than 20 miles an hour, that has a significant impact not only for the flight pattern and then the landing and the tumble that might occur from that, but also from the actual impact itself, let alone whether or not they're wearing gear or not. Those bodies are still going through energy transfer, and we need to be very suspicious that patients that have that sort of a mechanism are receiving the right level of suspicion and going to a trauma center so that they're at the right place with the right resources in case they do have a major injury. Looking at the fourth set of criteria here, this is looking at special populations, comorbidities that negatively affect trauma, that make trauma so much worse. So if we look at ages of our populace, older adults are at a much higher risk of injury death after the age of 55. So death as a result of an injury. That has to do with a lot of things like osteoporosis or the fact that the body becomes a lot less agile. It doesn't heal as fast. We get blood clots or we get compartmentalization easier. We start thinking about over the age of 55, patients are gonna be on medications that negatively impact us, or our heart just can't go through those same kinds of stresses, or I already suffer from borderline, organ problems. You know, as we get older, things just wear out a heck of a lot faster, and we're a lot more intolerant to insults like that. A systolic blood pressure of less than 110 might represent shock after the age of 65. Just like what we were talking about here, as we get older, things start to wear out. One of those common, comorbidities is hypertension. Maybe I'm normally at 140 or 150 systolic every single day, and that's where my normal blood pressure is. And now all of a sudden, I've gone through this accident, I'm in a compensatory state, but the next blood pressure that's taken here is 110. At face value, that looks okay. But if my normal blood pressure is 150 and now I'm at 110, that's a 40-point drop in my systolic performance here. If we translated that over to somebody with a 120 over 80 blood pressure, 40 points less than 120, I mean, we're dealing with somebody who has a systolic blood pressure of 80 in that particular example. So don't get so caught up in the numbers here. Look at your patient. Is this normal for them? A low blood pressure for a patient who normally suffers from hypertension may be a critical sign that this patient is in a compensatory state. Low impact mechanisms like ground level falls, they can still result in severe injuries when we get older. Once again, referring back to osteoporosis, banging our heads, or even just being intolerant of blunt forces that crack things, or even our ability to try to cope with and recover from those sorts of things as we get older is much more difficult. Children, when we're considering an age, They should be triaged preferentially to a pediatric-capable trauma center. Now, with us, we're still going to be taking pretty much everything to Salem Hospital for stabilization and triage so we can figure out where this patient needs to go. We have to remember that kids, you know, they're not just little adults. They have different anatomy in some cases, right? Kids have, they're almost like an orange balanced on top of a toothpick, and we're talking about their head in comparison to their neck and their torso. And kids are very head heavy. They like to fall head first, whereas us adults that have packed on a few more pounds, we like to fall a bit more feet first or a bit more flat towards the ground. Kids, they like to tip forward and they like to go head first into things, which doesn't bode well when it's an orange on top of a toothpick and they're falling down on their body weight on top of their head. The other things as well with kids, their airways are less tolerant towards swelling. They have a conical shaped larynx, and it doesn't take much swelling or it doesn't take much mucus or blood to cause an airway occlusion. And if you're thinking back to your pediatric classes, kids are oxygen driven creatures. They do not take well to airway insults. You know, as soon as we start compromising a patient, like a child's airway, that's going to be one of the big signs of doom for a kid. So you have to remember that insults to the neck, insults to the head, insults to that whole orange on top of a toothpick, they can have some significant trauma from that. We think about patients that are part of the special population that are on anticoagulants or have bleeding disorders. When we're thinking about anticoagulation, these are going to be patients that are on blood thinners. So let's quickly review those here. We have Coumadin, which is also known as warfarin, commonly seen with patients who have like atrial fibrillation. They take that medication and they take it every single day. They need to do that to maintain anticoagulation so they don't throw a clot from their atria. Another common medication that you'll see with atrial fibrillation is Eliquis. It has some benefits over Coumadin, but you might see Eliquis out there as well. You also might see patients out there in the field who are taking clopidogrel. That's also known as Plavix, and they usually will take this after they have some sort of like heart hardware that is placed inside. So those are going to be like stents, or if they have like a coronary artery bypass graft or a CABG, they're going to take that to maintain blood flow through those pieces of hardware. So you might see patients that are on clopidogrel. Another medication that's out there, a little less common because that's a little spendy, is a medication called Pradaxa. Generally speaking, aspirin is not considered a significant enough blood thinner. Even a baby aspirin a day is not considered significant anticoagulation therapy. Now, something else though that we should put inside of our minds, sometimes patients that are coming from like a skilled nursing facility, or maybe we're with a patient here who's being transferred from one location to another, or a patient who's, you know, normally on bed rest for a long period of time, they might actually be on injections of low molecular weight heparin. These are going to be heparin injections that go usually into the belly, into the subcutaneous tissue there, to help that patient prevent having blood clots in their legs. So patients like that don't do well with drops of the gurney or accidental falls or slips and falls while we're standing up and moving them. And we should be very considerate about that when we're transferring patients during interfacility transfers, or when we're transferring patients that are coming from skilled nursing facilities that might be receiving low molecular weight heparin injections, that is absolutely going to be considered anticoagulation. All right, looking more again at special populations here, burns. Without other trauma mechanisms here, burns should be taken to the local burn facility where they are more readily set up and they're more ready to take care of these patients with very specific treatment regimens. The patient, however, that has suffered a burn and other traumatic injuries as well, they should be taken to the local trauma center if you have a choice between the burn facility and the trauma center, and those are two separate facilities. Not really what we're doing here in Salem, because we have our one hospital and it's just a one-stop shop. However, if we were working in another area, or if you were transferring and you had to make that choice, if you have burns with associated trauma, they need to go to a trauma center. Other special populations, in the presence of trauma, pregnancy over 20 weeks, should be considered a unstable patient and they need to be transported and monitored so we can make sure that there wasn't any sort of violation or weakening or bleeding inside of that developing area inside of the belly. We can easily, you know, jostle things or move things or have insults to those area that can not only affect mom, but it can also affect baby as well. This is probably the biggest gray area underneath the special populations. There is another section here called EMS provider judgment. Now, everything that we've talked to up until this point, it strives to really try to be as inclusive as we can. In no way, shape, or form does all of the rest of these guidelines cover all the potential things that we could see out there in the field. So when you get on scene and you see this patient that has significant risk to life or limb with something that is not described in any of these guidelines, this is your carte blanche access here to be able to call that trauma alert from the field based on what you're seeing there when you're at the patient's side, what you're seeing with all of the patient's information, that you are going to call ahead and say, this patient needs special consideration as a trauma patient. We're going to make them an activation based on that EMS provider judgment. Just make sure that you're also able to explain that when you get into the hospital, you're able to paint that picture about why this patient tripped those alarms to you. Why did this patient make the hairs on the back of your neck stand up? What was associated with this didn't quite fit these other categories or criterium here, but you're looking at this patient and you're just for certain that this patient needs immediate access to all of the trauma facility resources and get with those trauma experts as quickly as they can.
All of this information is from our EMS side, but to further elaborate on what happens when we bring in a trauma system activation, I was able to schedule a meeting with Salem Hospital. I spoke with Amy Slater, who is a trauma system coordinator. She tracks all of the trauma cases throughout the hospital. She also works as the EMS liaison officer. She provides feedback on many of our traumas. Hello, Amy. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today and to help us understand a little about what trauma is on your side of the spectrum. My first question would be the green trauma bands. What are they for? What do they do? And where do they end up?
Okay, excellent question. You probably know, and your people probably know this, the green trauma bands come from the Oregon Health Authority, from the state. We all get distributed them, whether you're EMS, pre-hospital, or a trauma hospital itself. Not all hospitals are trauma hospitals, but those of us that are, we request these bands from the state, and it really is tracking. It's all it is. It's funny when, as an ED nurse, I was always taught that these green bands are like gold, right? And they're like super, super important. And they are super important because we use them to track trauma patients throughout the state. So even if, say, you bring us a patient here and then we send them north, that patient is tracked through the trauma system with that green band. So for that, it is really important. But once that number is recorded, it's the number really that we track. So we keep our own supply here as well. And so we can assign a number. It's really the number that we're assigning. So as long as the number gets into the EMR, then the band can come off. Perfect. Really.
Nice. That's always something I've always wondered. It's like, oh, we have these bands, but it's like, what do they do? You know?
So. Yep.
Perfect. Kind of my next question. Is there such thing as pulse trauma activations, and are they like detrimental, such as like our cardiac alerts or STEMI activations? Like, does it bring down the statistic or?
Well, in the trauma system, we refer to those as over triage versus under triage. And we're all held to specific state criteria. EMS criteria is very similar to hospital criteria. We have the flexibility of adding a couple of things, adding to it if we want to, but by and large, we all operate under the same activating criteria. So if a paramedic in the field says, I want to make this a trauma, and again, you can use discretionary without any of the specific criteria, then we as a facility must activate that trauma. We can't say, no, that's not a trauma. So that is a trauma activation. And if it ends up that the patient doesn't have any injuries, then it's not really something that is counted against or anything like that. The state holds hospitals to an over triage level of 50%. It's very generous. And versus the under triage is only 10%. So of course they want people to err on the side of caution versus versus under triaging that person who is injured, not getting recognized, not getting into the system. So the state is much more generous in the over triage. What it does for us, if they end up not having an injury, we really trust EMS eyes and your assessment in the field. So we will mobilize our resources based on your report and the vital signs of the patient. And we have two different levels of trauma activation, which I'm sure you know. Mm-hmm. We've got the modified and we've got the full. So generally, if this person is sounding pretty stable and they don't meet those full trauma criteria, then we'll do a modified criteria. And it's really the ED staff that responds to those. So we always prefer that you over triage versus under triage. We're okay with that.
And when you activate like your full triage sort of activation, what mm-hmm. all kind of implies? I know that you pull in, you know, a trauma surgeon, mm-hmm. you're warming up blood, prioritizing imaging. Is there anything else that kind of falls into that as far as all the staff?
Yeah, on a full trauma activation, again, it's the same type of criteria as your highest level that you have in the field. We have it broken out between full and modified, that's state criteria. But the difference between what you get with a full trauma activation versus a modified is, like you mentioned, you get the trauma surgeon. The trauma surgeon is required to respond within 15 minutes of receiving the page. The OR responds, blood bank gets the trauma pack together. We also have our house supervisor notified in case there's any other sort of coordination that needs to happen. But the big players are outside the ED or the OR, the trauma surgeon, and the blood bank.
When you start warming up blood, plasma, and platelets, can those be refrozen if it's a wrong activation, or do we have to use those within a certain period of time?
They cannot be refrozen, and it's just the FFP plasma that is frozen. So they will issue as a trauma pack, and it is the first part of that 1-to-1-to-1 ratio. So we get 4 units of red cells, 4 units of plasma of the FFP, and then the platelets actually come in the second pack because it's a very large bag and it completes the ratio of both packs. So if we don't use that, we send it back up to the blood bank. And they do store it, but they don't refreeze it, and it will be used on another patient.
Oh, very nice. Mm-hmm.
The platelets are the most valuable and the ones that we have in the lowest quantities.
Is there any like statistics in 2020 that have shot out to you? Has traumas gone way up or has traumas gone way down this year?
Yeah, it's interesting. We're always curious to see what are the COVID effects in the trauma world. And in April, when everything went into a hard lockdown, we did see a decrease in our trauma numbers then. But we've spent the rest of the year really making up for that decrease. And so now in December, we are at about 1% of our previous month, year's volume. So we're pretty much even to where we were last year. Now, that being said, we have had a steady incline year over year. So we're gonna flatten out a little bit this year. But the interesting thing was in August, we had our highest number of trauma patients ever. We had 203 trauma system activations in August.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, so that broke all of our records since we became a trauma center. So we had that 1 month that really was very intense and lots of trauma. And we're also looking at, with COVID, our bed availability, especially right now. So we're keeping a close eye on our OR availability, our ICU availability in relation to COVID patients and making sure we have capacity for all the other patients besides COVID patients.
Yeah, that's interesting. I never would have guessed that in August.
I know. Yeah. The ED census overall has been less and has not made it up. But the trauma census has remained pretty steady.
Everyone's just, you know, breaking out. They're tired of being locked down, you know?
I guess so.
What can we do to help your job better? Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we need to kind of keep an eye out for specific things on specific, mm-hmm. on specific patients, like, is there anything that we can do mm-hmm. to help the ED accept a trauma patient the best?
Let me think. As part of the statewide trauma system, each hospital is responsible for sending feedback back to EMS. And so I usually do that through Matt, and I send him in the moment feedback. I send him, you know, long reports that I'm sure he just, you know, is like, oh my gosh, here's another long report. But one of the things that we notice a lot of in, say, the under triage category is intrusion of the vehicle. And there's some confusion, I think, out there from agency to agency about what, how to interpret that. And so it's 12 inches within the passenger compartment itself, and then 18 inches anywhere else in the car. And so that's the part that gets a little tricky. We might have a patient who doesn't have any passenger compartment intrusion, but maybe the front end of the car is gone, and they can still have significant injuries with that. So I would always say, make sure you pay attention to the intrusion. Not that you have like a ruler out there or, you know, a tape measure and you're measuring it, but don't discount the intrusion in the rest of the car, because it can certainly have that transfer of forces that would cause significant injury.
I did a Zoom training, was it 2 months ago, I think, about mechanism of injuries. And, you know, our patient may be up and out of the car, but if the car's destroyed, it's like, you know, we got to make our best judgment.
Right. We're doing some work right now. We've kind of instituted a new flow here in the ED for those patients who don't actually meet trauma entry criteria. Those patients who aren't in that neat and tidy box of, yes, you meet criteria and these different things. Because we've had a few patients who don't meet any sort of trauma entry criteria, with the exception of, I guess, discretionary, but they end up having significant injury. And so how do we spot those patients quicker? And so that is certainly information that would be helpful to you folks as well. So what we're looking at is these high-risk mechanisms that are likely to cause injury, but might not be so outwardly noticeable at the outset. And so we picked three criteria just to focus on, and one of those is seatbelt sign in MVCs. Because that's not an automatic entry that they have seatbelt sign, but it certainly represents a high risk situation. But it doesn't get you entry into the trauma system just based on that. So we have extra set of eyes on that if we spot seatbelt sign, to be a little bit more critical thinking on that patient. Also, if they're on any sort of anticoagulants, any thinners at all, and there's a mechanism, that person's at a higher risk for injury. Even though being on anticoagulants doesn't automatically put you in the trauma system. But if they have a mechanism, you should always be very suspicious. And then any sort of transfer of force. So the ED staff was telling me, some of the nurses, they were telling me, anything involving a horse should be a trauma system entry, right? So anytime a person falls off a horse, there's almost always an injury that requires admission to the hospital. So that's that transfer of force that we're talking about. And I always joke, anything involving a train. And that might seem like a no-brainer, but we have seen a few car crashes where like the front end of the car gets clipped and maybe the car gets spun around, but they're not entering the trauma system and they have significant injury. So I always joke that, you know, any of those, anything involving a train should be high suspicion. But just more broadly speaking, anything that is a transfer of energy, anything, like they said, almost anything involving a horse, there is some sort of significant injury there. So we're just trying to broaden out our staff's critical thinking skills outside of the box of this is a mandatory entry.
Yeah.
Just to catch some of these patients.
No, I think that right there, I think, is going to ring loud with our crews, because, you know, a lot of the times, especially like in car crashes, you know, like we get on scene and everybody's out of the vehicle walking around. Mm-hmm. That's our first sort of, no one's still in the vehicle, but vehicles have crumple points, you know, they look destroyed. Mm-hmm. But since everyone's out, we kind of just are, I think our, a lot of the times our level of suspicion drops. They're like, oh, right. Everyone's out, everyone's right. Cool.
Mm-hmm.
The training that I did was on hidden traumas, pneumothoraxes, pelvic injuries, or just and abdominal injuries. Just mm-hmm. things that we don't obviously see.
Right. We sort of had this aha moment because we had a patient that really focused our attention and really kind of prompted us to do this work. And then Dr. Allison and I, Dr. Allison is our trauma medical director. She's one of the trauma surgeons, right? And so we attend our area trauma advisory board meeting quarterly, which is all the area hospitals within the North Willamette Valley. And this was on our mind, but then before we could even discuss it, the medical director from McMinnville raised the same concern, saying, hey, we want to work on how to recognize injuries in patients that don't meet criteria. And it was really just this aha moment where we're meeting as a regional group and we're coming across the same scenario across several different hospitals. So it was like, okay, that's confirmation that this is a thing. So I would be happy to share our flow chart that we made in looking at this. And we're also, as sort of a countermeasure, going, okay, are we entering too many people that we don't need to? Is there some trending that we're seeing? So we're just keeping an eye on that. It's something that we just sent down in the last month or so. So we're just keeping an eye on, are we, you know, swinging the pendulum the opposite direction and using up too many resources?
Yeah, I would love to see that.
Okay, so I'll send that to you.
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay.
I think that's about all I got for you. This has been extremely beneficial for me personally, as well as when we get to push this out to the crew. So thank you for doing this for us.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to do this anytime. So
I would love to continue to do follow-ups. And
Absolutely. And you can send questions. And
Salem and EMS are partners. Like, we should be plugged in on a lot of different things. So
yeah. Dr. Allison, I would love to get back. We were out in the community last year doing quarterly case reviews. And of course, we're hampered by that right now. But even doing a format like this, WebEx is a platform that we use, you know, isn't impossible. We would love to do that out and to just invite everybody, because with WebEx, you can do that and have a large group. Just trying to get together with some of the EMS leadership and say, okay, is this something that we can resume in this format versus before we were going out to different stations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we would love to be a part of that. So.
Okay, we'll continue to work on that. Okay.
All right, well, thank you again. I'll let you get back to your day.
Okay, well, thank you. I hope you have a good day.
Thank you, too.
Hearing our old guidelines from Cole and the input we got from the hospital side of trauma, I hope this makes you more comfortable with activating a trauma system entry. I hope you can fall back on this knowledge, and when we meet these trauma patients, we can use this knowledge to have a higher level of suspicion, even when, you know, circumstances may be not so obvious. You know, if we have a suspicion that this patient may be critical, go ahead and make that trauma system activation. It's better to over-triage than under-triage. Now, when you decide to activate a trauma, make sure after you band that patient with the green band, we're getting that number written down, and that number, as Amy said, follows the patient throughout the whole process. So making sure you have that number is pretty important. Also, our communication with the hospital is important. There's specific sort of information that the hospital needs when we make our HEAR report when activating a trauma. This information is as such: your unit number and the location of the incident, the number of patients you are bringing in, the age and sex of the patient, the trauma system criteria, and the vital signs. So whichever step that patient meets in our guidelines, always be sure to mention that. Their GCS score, and your estimated time of arrival. If by chance you are responding to a rural area and the patient meets specific criteria and you believe that it will benefit the patient, an air ambulance is always an option for us as well. Sometimes we gotta respond to calls way outside our jurisdiction, and it's gonna take a prolonged time to get to that trauma center. We absolutely can pull that trigger. Thanks for listening and stay safe.
Here is a question for you. What do you think cases of hypertension in humans, large pit viper snakes from Brazil and Argentina, acute cases of idiopathic face, lip, and tongue swelling, as well as monitoring your intake of bananas and green leafy vegetables, all have in common? Though this question may initially leave you asking if I'm having a stroke myself and need an ambulance sent to my location, the answer to this riddle is actually ACE inhibitor medications, like lisinopril. In this, our newest segment of the podcast, we intend to take deeper dives on common prescription medications and how they might impact us in the field to add to your medical knowledge and giving you a deeper appreciation for the M section of your sample history taking. So first off, what is lisinopril? Lisinopril is a type of medication called an angiotensin converting enzyme inhibitor. It works by blocking a substance in the body that causes blood vessels to tighten. As a result, lisinopril relaxes blood vessels. This lowers blood pressure and increases the supply of blood and oxygen to the heart. Lisinopril is a long-acting drug. In most adult patients, it starts to work in about an hour, with peak antihypertensive properties occurring about 6 hours after taking a single oral dose. For some patients, it may take as long as 2 to 4 weeks to achieve optimal results. ACE inhibitors are prevalent in the United States and comprise 30% of all U.S. hypertension prescriptions. A history of lisinopril. Sir John Robert Vane, a professor of experimental pharmacology at the Institute for Basic Medical Sciences at the Royal College of Surgeons in England, as well as a Brazilian postdoctoral student by the name of Sergio Ferreira, were experimenting with hypertension and bradykinin potentiating factor. This extract from the venom of the Brazilian viper, known as yayara, is a species of highly venomous pit viper endemic to South America, in southern Brazil, Paraguay, and northern Argentina. Bradykinin potentiating factor was tested and found to be a potent inhibitor of angiotensin converting enzyme. So Dr. Vane, as well as Sergio Ferreira, were subsequently awarded the Nobel Prize in 1982 for this work with prostaglandins. Another set of individuals, David Cushman and Miguel Ondetti, they succeeded in turning the viper snake venom peptide, which initially required injection for action, into an oral dosage form in the mid to late 1970s. The first ACE inhibitor, captopril, also known as captopen, was approved by the FDA in 1981. Since then, about 10 ACE inhibitors are currently available in the US for treating hypertension, and all are available as generic drugs. Some of these names, you'll start to notice, have a common suffix at the end of them. Benazepril, which is also known as Lotensin, Captopril, and Enalapril, also known as Vasotec, Fosinopril, also known as Monopril, Lisinopril, which can also be sold as Zestril or Privenil, Moexapril, which is Univasc, Quinalapril, which is Acupril, and Ramapril and Trandolapril. In addition, most ACE inhibitors are approved to treat heart failure, and some are even used to prevent nephropathy, ongoing kidney disease as a result of limited to low blood flow to the kidneys as a result of hypertension. Sometimes it is supplied in combination with HCTZ. How many times have you seen that in your patient's medical history? Which stands for hydrochlorothiazide. Lisinopril and hydrochlorothiazide in combination are used to treat high blood pressure. High blood pressure adds to the workload of the heart and arteries. If it continues for a long time, the heart and arteries may not function properly. This can damage the blood vessels of the brain, heart, and kidneys, resulting in a stroke, heart failure, or kidney failure. By lowering this blood pressure, we can reduce the risk of these strokes and heart attacks or organ damage. Hydrochlorothiazide is a thiazide diuretic, also known as a water pill by layman's terms, reduces the amount of water in the body by increasing the flow of urine, which helps lower blood pressure. Hydrochlorothiazide controls high blood pressure, but it does not cure it. Hydrochlorothiazide is a class of medications called a diuretic. It works by causing the kidneys to get rid of this unneeded water and salt, but more specifically, hydrochlorothiazide is another class of diuretics known as a potassium-sparing diuretic. Hydrochlorothiazide is used to treat edema caused by various medical problems like heart failure or liver disease, and it's used to treat the edema caused by certain medications, including estrogen use or the use of corticosteroids. And it accomplishes this while not allowing the body to leach potassium, leading to a potentially harmful hypokalemia. Unlike other diuretics like Lasix, which actually cause the user to lose potassium readily into the urine, requiring somebody who's taking Lasix to be on a potassium supplement, whereas somebody who's taking hydrochlorothiazide or hydrochlorothiazide lisinopril combinations to not require a potassium supplementation. Some other examples of potassium-sparing diuretics that you might see in combination with lisinopril instead of hydrochlorothiazide, a spironolactone, and triamterene. Going back to lisinopril here, which is our main focus of this deep dive, some side effects of lisinopril. In cases of acute overdose, for high blood pressure, adults at first, they start at 10 milligrams once a day and may prescribe all the way up to 40 milligrams per day. However, an overdose of lisinopril can happen at any range of that and is usually dependent upon the person's body weight and their own internal chemistry. An overdose of lisinopril can cause dizziness, sleepiness, and a pounding heartbeat, as well as devastating hypotension in the patient's body. And there is no direct antidote for ACE inhibitor overdoses. So I can't give you something like in the cases of Narcan versus opioids. There's no direct antidote that solves this ACE inhibitor overdose. For treatment of overdoses, we're going to be focusing on maintaining that patient's blood pressure to a MAP score of 65 or greater using vasoconstricting medications like epinephrine, as well as additional fluid applications and positioning the patient to best provide blood flow to the organs and to the brain. Another common side effect of lisinopril is a condition known as a lisinopril cough. Lisinopril and ACE inhibitors can produce this dry cough, and the cause of which is suspected that ACE inhibitors cause the body to increase nitric oxide production in the blood. And nitric oxide is known to irritate the lungs and cause this possible coughing spell. The cough luckily requires no treatment other than to discontinue use of the drug. Since ACE inhibitors have a very short half-life, it usually takes no longer than a day to excrete the ACE inhibitor from your body, and the cough will resolve itself after that. Another side effect of use of lisinopril is lisinopril causes increasing levels of potassium in your blood. Lisinopril food interactions consist of foods high in potassium. Lisinopril can increase blood potassium levels, so using salt substitutes or eating high potassium foods may cause problems. Foods to avoid in excess include bananas, oranges, potatoes, tomatoes, squash, and dark leafy greens. Looking at though, the most severe side effect of lisinopril is a condition known as angioedema. So let's break that word down at first. Angio means blood vessel. Edema means a condition characterized by excess watery fluid collecting in the cavities or tissues of the body. So what is angioedema? Angioedema is a condition whose presentation ranges from mild symptoms to a life-threatening condition. Angioedema is a self-limiting and localized swelling of the skin and mucosal membranes, usually lasting up to 72 hours. It can be acute or chronic. It's usually transient, but often reoccurs. Angioedema tends to involve loose connective tissue, such as the face, lips, mouth, throat, and larynx, with presenting symptoms ranging from cough, swelling, itching, and difficulty breathing, all the way up and unto airway obstruction. It occasionally involves the gastric and bowel mucosa, leading to symptoms such as nausea and vomiting as a result of swelling in the GI tract. The funny thing about this reaction is, this reaction doesn't usually happen with the first few doses of taking an ACE inhibitor, but rather occurs weeks or months or even years after the patient has been taking lisinopril or any ACE inhibitor regularly, and it doesn't necessarily happen to everyone. By population, in the United States, the reported overall lifetime incidence of angioedema is approximately 10% to 15%. ACE inhibitors and ACE inhibitor-regulated angioedema represents 30% to 40% of all cases of reported angioedema seen in the United States ERs. African American women have higher incidences of ACE inhibitor angioedema in comparison to other people in other populations. Other predisposing factors may include people over the age of 65 years old, people who regularly smoke tobacco products, use of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, seasonal allergies, obesity also plays a factor in this, a history of organ transplant and a history of ACE inhibitor associated coughs. Angioedema can happen spontaneously, and this is known as idiopathic angioedema, arising from seemingly nowhere, and accounts for 38% of all cases of reported angioedema. This can be driven by a hereditary flaw, or perhaps an allergic reaction, or even a chemical deficiency in the intra or extracellular space. Other forms of angioedema that arise from lisinopril's use can be driven by autosomal disorders, or even acquired protein deficiencies and malignancies. Looking at this from a recognition side, look for signs of facial swelling. Swelling of the lips, eyes, and tongue. Interestingly, a small percentage of cases of angioedema will have unilateral swelling of the tongue, meaning that only one side of the tongue swells versus the other. This is not unique, but the patients can have full swelling of the tongue. But either way, the swelling is usually non-pitting, meaning that any tissue that starts to swell becomes hard, swollen, and it doesn't dimple when it's touched or compressed, and it remains firm. So if you're like me, this should immediately start raising some major red flags towards EMS providers. A patient who's on lisinopril, who's been taking this medication for months or years, and suddenly has onset of focused facial swelling, swelling to their mouth or their tongue and their lips. This can make breathing and managing their own secretions very difficult. You know, we're usually taking this for hypertension, which usually means I'm taking this later on in life. I have lots of comorbidities. I might already have cardiac problems or respiratory problems. I might be suffering from neurologic problems where, you know, maybe I'm in a nursing home or something else. Maybe I just started taking this medication to start pre-treating my hypertension, and I'm just not all that aware of this medication, thinking that I'm taking a low dose, thinking I'm taking a medication that is relatively benign in order to just make sure that I curb this hypertension before it becomes a problem. Then suddenly this patient presents with facial swelling, swelling to their mouth or their tongue or their face. And we initially look at this as this must be an acute problem. What did I use here today? Was it a nut or was it a shellfish allergy? Was it something else? But nothing seems to be cropping up. The patient didn't switch facial washes, or the patient didn't switch like maybe makeup products, or didn't come in contact with a substance or a chemical or something that we can identify. But then we look in their medical history and we see this patient is taking any ACE inhibitor. We're going to be looking at this patient as this acute airway evaluation and acute airway management. And this is going to be one of the first and most important steps in the approach to treating a patient with potentially an ACE inhibitor angioedema. Even in the ER, when we're starting to look at controlling this patient's airway, nasotracheal intubation is usually preferred to secure the airway, since non-pitting edema can make oral intubation difficult or even impossible. The second most important step is to discontinue the offending agent. The angioedema that's secondary to these ACE inhibitors, it's usually self-limiting. Remember, this is a short-acting drug. And as soon as we stop taking it, the body starts to excrete it, we start to get rid of it, symptoms can start to resolve in 12 to 48 hours after discontinuation. Some cases can persist longer, but they're usually complicated with oropharyngeal and tongue swelling, which can compromise breathing, meaning these patients end up intubated on a ventilator for sometimes up to 3 to 4 days until the angioedema can kind of come down. Use of corticosteroids, antihistamines, both things like diphenhydramine or even like Pepcid, as well as epinephrine, are still used for the initial treatment of ACE inhibitor angioedema. However, no specific guidelines have been published in the United States about the right doses or how aggressively to use this. There are other types of medications that can be used in bradykinin-mediated angioedema or cases that are a result of hereditary, autosomal, or intracellular deficiency-related angioedema. But these have to be diagnosed through extensive lab results and testing. But it is a pivotal cornerstone when we look at this from the ongoing treatment. Once the patient arrives at the hospital, they want to try to identify what's driving this. Is this idiopathic, meaning that it spontaneously arose, kind of like an allergic reaction? Or was this patient predisposed to it? either through hereditary issues, or perhaps it's a malignancy that's causing this, or maybe it's a intracellular deficiency. And there are some very specific, albeit pretty expensive, medications out there that can help to reduce the side effects of angioedema in hospital, but identifying that is going to be a pretty lengthy process. So when we look at this from the EMS side, a thorough history and comprehensive physical exam are very important to determine the etiology of the angioedema. You know, there may be the absence or the presence of urticarial lesions or hives. This may alert us to the idea that the patient's having a reaction. But what's really interesting about angioedema in lisinopril is that about 70% of people have this reaction and they don't appear to be having a systemic allergic reaction with hives in their body anywhere else. Now, confusingly, about 30% of people will have hives related to this as well, so it makes it look just like an allergic reaction. Either way, I think everybody is going to get the gist of this patient looks like they have airway swelling, facial swelling, and we're all going to be attacking this in a way of being aggressive with that airway and trying to reduce those symptoms. So applying things like early access to epinephrine, early access to Benadryl and dexamethasone, consider early intubation of the patient before that facial swelling becomes so involved that we actually cannot intubate this patient and we're looking to have to move towards using like a cricothyrotomy in order to manage that patient's airway. And remember that angioedema is a condition whose presentation ranges from mild symptoms, like just the tongue starting to swell out of the mouth, or just a sudden swelling of like the lower lip or the upper lip, or maybe the eyes swelling shut or things, but can ramp itself up to include even more of those mucosal membranes and even more of the face, the larynx, the oropharynx, and can be very life-threatening. So looking overall at the the presence of lisinopril in our charts, the presence of use of these medications, remember that a lot of people are taking this every single day. And those people can still get stung by bees. Those patients can still have an unknown allergen in another case. But this is another tool to have in your toolbox to recognize that a patient is taking a medication that does have a potential side effect, and we should just be aware of that. We should be thinking about that. We're still going to be addressing allergic reactions and angioedema pretty much the same way from the EMS perspective. However, if we can identify this or be suspicious about angioedema and perhaps cue in or clue in the hospital that the patient is taking lisinopril, the focal, swelling really looks more angioedema, we're not having a lot of hives with this, or perhaps the patient has had a similar reaction to this in the past, that's going to help open up a lot of doors and start that process moving a little bit faster with that patient. So that's a quick summary about lisinopril, touching a little bit on hydrochlorothiazide and potassium-sparing diuretics. If you liked this section, or if you have any suggestions for future prescription medications that you've wondered about, or if there are medications that you're encountering that perhaps you think that we should focus on, drop us a line and shoot us an email. I'd like to guide some of these sections based upon the medications that you all are seeing in the field and have questions about, or even if it's procedural things or things like dialysis, I'd like to focus on those sorts of things too, to kind of illuminate them and to help us out guiding our treatments here into the future. For this month's employee spotlight, I arranged some time to speak with Corey Reynolds, who is a EMT with Falck and is currently going through paramedic school and working his way up the chain to eventually transition to becoming a paramedic. So welcome, Corey.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going great, man. It's going great. Thanks for making the time to jump in and do this. I know you were just studying and doing stuff like that, kind of trying to stay on top of it for school. So thanks for waking up to do this.
Yeah. I get my Z's in.
Yeah. Yeah. How long have you been in EMS? How long have you been doing the job?
So I started in 2012. I was 16 years old. I became a student firefighter the agency I volunteer at currently. And ever since then, I've just been with it. I got my EMT in 2017, and so I'm coming up on 9 years now.
What made you want to get into EMS at 16, or even just, you know, first response or fire service or whatever? Like, what was the draw for you then?
So I've always been attracted to helping people. I originally wanted to be a chef, actually, and own a restaurant. And I wanted to cook for people. And I had a conversation with my scoutmaster while I was in Boy Scouts. And we discussed my attraction to firefighting because my buddies did it at the fire department. And they were all 16 fighting fires. And so I decided to, on a whim, just join up and see if I liked it. And ever since then, I've just been super into it.
And I know that even in the fire service, there's a certain amount of cooking that you're going to end up having to do anyways. So you're going to be able to combine chef and firefighting maybe with all of that too, right?
Yeah, so it's been good. I can practice both skills.
Chef Boyardee and breaking down walls. All right.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. What was some of your first memories of actually doing patient care, or like your experience in medicine in comparison to firefighting?
I think some of my first experience with patient care is when I became a sleeper at an agency when I was 19. So I became a resident volunteer, and they were helping me pay to go to EMT school. And part of the deal was I would pull shifts there. And there they were very proactive with, you take patient care, you ask questions. And I remember one certain call where I did CPR for the first time. And that kind of really opened my eyes so that we do more than fight fires and take patients to the hospital. You know, it's a lot that goes into that.
Yeah, and I think if I remember correctly, you know, in my own career, very similar experiences where you get into those situations where you don't know what it's going to be like. You're forced to knock on wood, and you finally end up doing some of those skills, and you either are into it from that point on or you're not. And
yeah.
It's kind of one of those decision points about, nah, this wasn't for me. Or you end up saying, nope, that was for me. I really liked it. I want to do this again. I want to be that helper and that sort of thing. Does that resonate at all with you?
Yeah, it does. It was definitely a challenge. I think that was kind of my do you want to do this or not moment. And, you know, it was a very chaotic scene. It was one moment the patient was awake talking to us, and the next he is on the ground not breathing and pulseless. And so it was just a big moment for me. And that was actually my last shift at that department where I was being a sleeper. So it was kind of a wake-up call for, do I want to continue to do this? And I think, yeah, it did resonate for me. I decided that I wanted to take a step back from that department and kind of further my education elsewhere. And
if we fast forward then to, you know, your time that you started here with Falk, and you kind of bounced around from different shifts, I think you even worked some night shift and even worked some day shift and like mid shift and things, what kind of memories do you have as an EMT working with Falk?
That's a good question. My time here as an EMT at Falk started off very, very fresh and green. I worked as an EMT before here for a fire department, but it was wildly different than Falk. And so I think I definitely got thrown into the mix, and I went from a very green EMT to, I feel like, a very solid EMT pretty quick. Ran a lot of calls here at Falk, and I think
if you had to take a guess, how many calls you've run here since starting your career at Falk, how many calls do you think you've run?
Maybe 1,000.
Okay, that's a pretty good guess. I went back and I pulled the numbers on it. You've at least been listed as a crew member, not necessarily attended, but I mean, sometimes that's kind of a combination, right? You've been involved with 1,895 medical records as far back as I could look in our charting software.
Wow.
And I mean, so that's almost 2,000 medical records that you've been associated with, right? So then I like to take that even one level further than that. Imagine that each one of those calls, you just spent 1 hour doing patient care and transport and lifting and moving and everything else like that. That means that if we take that out, you've done 78 contiguous days of patient care at 1 hour per call. 78 days of your life, 24 hours a day, you've been with a patient, talking to a patient, asking questions.
Wow.
If we even take that number of calls and we average that out so that, let's say you're running 6 calls a shift at 1 hour a shift, you've worked an average of 315 shifts since you started working here. What do you think about all that?
That's wow. That's a lot. I didn't expect it to be that much.
They all start blending together, right? Just a little bit.
Yeah.
I think it also really contrasts, like when you start talking about experience, that's a lot of time that you've spent in and around people, in and around, you know, emergencies or sickness or injury or both, even just around patient scenes and operating with the incident command system. There's a lot of experience that you've built this career off of. Do you have any advice as an EMT, maybe a new EMT that's just starting their career, either how to work with a partner or how to function on scenes or even just how to survive EMS?
Yeah, I actually do. I think when I first got here, I was a little nervous, and I got put with some really good partners that trusted their EMTs. And the biggest advice I can give is have good communication with your partners and make sure you know what they're comfortable with giving you as an EMT, and be sure to ask questions, because we're here to learn. I think that's the biggest thing that helped me is I asked a lot of questions. If my paramedic partner took a patient in that I thought I could take in, I would ask why they took that patient in and what they were thinking. And it kind of helped me connect the dots as an EMT. And even now as a paramedic student, it's starting to make more sense that we don't just do things to do it. We have a rhyme and reason for it.
Yeah, so now like transitioning into being that paramedic student, what's been some of the lessons you've learned about taking your brain and changing it from the way you looked at things as an EMT and now moving it over into becoming a paramedic?
It's challenging to be the person that's the leader, that's making those decisions. Because as an EMT, it was a lot of logistics, how can I move this gurney? How can I get these bags out? How can I help my partner? Now as a paramedic, I feel it's a lot more what's going on with the patient, what's going on, deep inside, like their physiology and all of those things. And that's been a challenge, is connecting all of the dots. That's been my experience since, 2012 even, to now, what's going on with this person? Why are they calling 911 today? And how can we help? That's been a challenge because it's so much information that it just, it's like drinking from a fire hose from both ends,
Well, then you add the delegation side into it. The EMT, who's now doing something for the very first time, is looking to you to connect with them to not only say, hey, is this right? They want feedback on what they're doing, which, you as an EMT, you are looking for that from your paramedic partner. You're now in that position of being that mentor or being that, correction person on scene who's pushing us towards doing better medicine, moving that patient towards definitive medical care. Just like you're saying, I remember that being one of my things I struggled with as well, was learning how to delegate, learning how to be educational and motivational, and still getting the job done while monitoring the whole thing from like that 10-foot view over the top of the patient, watching what everybody's doing and making sure the call's going the way that I need it to go, and trying to motivate the person and seeing them, oh, this may be the first time they're doing CPR.
Yeah.
Coaching them into it and telling them, hey, how can we do it better? But keeping them going because we need them there. You have any pearls of wisdom from it?
With the delegation part?
Yeah.
I'm doing better. It was hard at first because for me, I don't like to tell people what to do and come off rude, but I know that it's important to delegate and get the job done because we're all there for one job. And it's been hard because I'm a person that believes that I can do everything by myself and I don't like to burden people. And so it's been hard to kind of step back and realize that we're a team. And it's okay that other team members are doing other things. And, the agency I'm interning at has been a huge help with transitioning to that because we've worked on my confidence and we've worked on scenarios and it's starting to click now. And so, I have no problem telling, an officer, hey, get an IV for me. And I have no problem delegating whoever I'm with to be doing skills. And so it just takes time, but I think it's starting to come around now, and I'm starting to realize that I'm not being bossy. I'm getting the job done for the patient, and it's all about the patient.
You know, when we set this whole thing up, I wanted to ask you how school looks. You know, I went to paramedic school in 2004, and in 2004, you know, we didn't have the same challenges we do now. What kind of challenges are you facing in paramedic school right now with COVID?
I think the biggest challenge for me and my other classmates, and we definitely are very frustrated about it, is solidifying the knowledge that we're getting. You know, I feel like people who go into this business, and especially like nursing and doctors, they're very hands-on. We like to learn and we like to hear something and do something. And I feel like the same for paramedicine. And the challenge is we haven't had that solidification of those skills. You know, we learn about, you know, pneumothoraxes, but we never got the hands-on of, you know, how to do a chest decompression until way later. And so the skills never solidified and the dots kind of never connected right away. And so it's been a challenge. You know, we make a joke, we're the YouTube medics. We've had to learn most of our skills on YouTube.
That's interesting. And it's been, I imagine that's a lot of that is going to matriculate out then to now your preceptor, who's someone who's going to be able to be at your side and watching you do things, that a lot more of your skills checkoffs and a lot more of the hands-on skills are going to happen in the field or even after graduation when you go to start your field internship as a new licensed medic, that there's going to be a lot more weighted on people at that point to kind of do the hands-on skills. Yeah. That's tough, man. That's really tough.
Yeah. And it's a lot of information to take in because all of our lectures have been in this format of Zoom. And it's hard to ask questions and kind of solidify those skills over the computer because, you know, we can only be lectured so much before we need to either see it or have some kind of Q&A.
Yeah. Have you guys come up with anything as like a workaround to try to bridge those gaps just yet?
Our instructor at the campus has been super proactive with trying to get us the best education. And he's put on social distance labs in the labs. We're not working close in contact with my fellow students. And so we have the 6 stations set up and each person is at that station and they're social distanced. And we've been able to practice our skills without being close to each other. But the theme that I think has helped me from that experience is working on my closed loop communication, because we have to yell across the room, hey, I want an IV. Hey, I want you to do compressions. And so that is one positive thing that's come out from it and has worked pretty well, I think. And our instructor has done a really good job of making sure we get something.
Interesting. You know? I had one more question for you. And that's, you know, when you're done with your paramedic, when you're done with your paramedic school and you're out there and you're working in the field, where is it that you want to go? Like, where does Corey Reynolds want to be with his, you know, career path?
Chef for Gordon Ramsay.
Yeah.
Paramedic for Gordon Ramsay. That's man. You know, I've been thinking about it a lot, and I would like to be with a fire department and be a paramedic for a transporting fire department. I really enjoy EMS and transporting people and being a thinking paramedic. But I am thinking about going to PA school.
Interesting.
And I really enjoy how PA is similar to paramedic in the sense that you still work under a doctor, but you still have a little bit of autonomy and you're able to practice on your own and kind of stretch your fingers and think about the bigger picture. And I really enjoy that. It would be cool to work as a PA, as an emergency room, and help really sick people.
Sure. Yeah, I think your medic is actually going to be able to help you bridge that gap as you gain experience as a medic. It's all going to be very complementary to one another. Your skills are just going to change and your approach is going to change and the environment where you're doing it's going to change. I'd imagine though, you'd even have a whole lot to tell new paramedics that are rolling in the door as a PA and continue to mentor them, you know, from your experience then as a medic.
Yeah.
Very cool, man. Thank you again for taking the time to jump on here and to talk to us about this. And, you know, thank you for spending all the time here with Falk. And can't wait to see you get done with school and can't wait to see you out there in the field.
Me either. I'm ready.
All right. Thank you. For this next piece, I'd like to add on to Dustin's discussion of our trauma alert protocols, and I wanted to discuss permissive hypotension. However, before we can talk about that, let's review the clotting cascade as well as pH balance in the body so we can really have a good grip on this concept. To start, let's look at how clotting works. Blood clotting, or coagulation, is an important process that prevents excessive bleeding when a blood vessel is injured. Platelets, a type of blood cell, and proteins in your plasma, which is the liquid part of the blood, work together to stop the bleeding by forming a clot over the injury. The clotting cascade is a triggered collection of steps that eventually leads to the formation of a sticky net of fibers that allows for the formation of a clot. This is called a fibrin mesh. Clot formation is triggered to begin when either a blood vessel, the blood vessel wall, or the surrounding tissue is injured or disrupted. This releases an enzyme called tissue thromboplastin, which combines with calcium ions that are in the surrounding tissue to eventually cascade down a chain of events to convert prothrombin into thrombin. This is also known as factor 10 and eventually activated factor 10. This process is called the extrinsic pathway of the clotting cascade, or in more simple terms, it is blood clots being formed in the presence of tissue trauma from an external source. Now there's another process here called the intrinsic pathway, and that generally it is triggered formation of clots due to blood cell death or rupture or stagnation of the blood cells inside of the blood vessels. Think unmoving blood caught in a constricted blood vessel or inside of the atria of the heart during atrial fibrillation where the blood doesn't actively get ejected from the atria, leaving it to swirl and stagnate inside of the folds of those papillary muscles. Or secondary to a medical device, causing turbulence of blood cells and perhaps even tearing them apart inside of the blood vessels. The intrinsic pathway has different initial signals that are released and also require the presence of calcium ions to kick off the clotting cascade. But the end result is the same. It cascades down to eventually the creation of thrombin from prothrombin. And in both cases, once that thrombin has been activated, it converts fibrinogen to fibrin, which leads to the formation of a fibrin mesh, which is a collection, again, of sticky, attractive chains and nets. This net, it captures other blood cells, phospholipids, proteins, white blood cells, and other platelets to form that plug and eventually get us all the way to hemostasis. So how does saline affect all of this? Well, to better understand this, we need to quickly refresh some chemistry and bring it back to the front of our mind. So let's start with saline and saline's chemistry. Saline is primarily water with a solution of sodium and chloride added to it. It comes in various concentrations, known as either a hypertonic solution or a concentration that's higher than the standard bodily values, or hypotonic, or a concentration is less than the standard bodily values, or perhaps even isotonic saline, which is as close to the average standard bodily value as possible. This is also known as a crystalloid solution. We also need to review the chemistry of water now, but we have to understand that water is both an acid and a base. It can remove free hydrogen from substances, or it can even donate its own hydrogen back into substances. This is the fundamental basis of what's called the per hydrogen scale, or the pH scale. It's measuring the amount of hydrogen and free hydrogen that is available inside of a solution. Water attempts to actively balance things out in our blood by either robbing hydrogen out of a solution and forming a substance called hydronium, which is H3O instead of H2O. This makes the substance more acidic by removing free hydrogen and lessening that pH scale. Or water can even donate its own hydrogen, forming OH negative. This is called a hydroxyl versus H2O. It becomes OH negative. This adds even more hydrogen to a solution and thus is now raising that pH value, making that number even higher. This is going to make that solution more basic or more alkalinic. So the lower the pH scale gets, the more acidic it is. The higher the pH scale gets, the more basic it is. Either way, we're describing the amount of hydrogen available in that solution. So let's turn our attention back to saline now. It is primarily water, that H2O, but it is also a combination of sodium and chloride suspended inside of it. Specifically, if we're talking about isotonic saline, this is 0.9% salt solution, that crystalloid solution. This means that I have both sodium ions and chloride ions running around inside of it. Saline's pH is around 5.5, which means that saline is an acidic solution, far more than the body. Whereas the human body, it actually needs to be slightly alkaline in order to be back to its homeostatic range. That's going to be 7.35 to 7.45, with 7 being the midpoint between acids and bases. This means that when I add saline to someone, I'm actually dumping that acidic solution into their body. I'm pushing that pH scale lower. I'm adding in a solution here that's actually going to start to remove even more of that free hydrogen from their system. And it's even going to interact with other ions, including it's going to react a whole lot with chloride. So as those things start to react and start to combine, the human body is now going to attempt to regulate that. And the human body likes to regulate pH via two mechanisms. One is going to be with the release of bicarbonate inside of your blood, and the other one is going to be through respiration. So let's look at those two mechanisms here. One of those two mechanisms, respiration, okay, it's dealing with adjusting our pH by removing CO2 out of our blood, that carbon dioxide out of our blood. We're going to attempt to decrease CO2 from the blood, which is transported either bound to the blood proteins themselves or even in solution as carbonic acid. When we remove that carbonic acid, when we offload the CO2 and we breathe it back out, this is going to help to stabilize that blood pH back to more of a basic level. Now, why is that? The answer lies actually in bicarbonate ions here, which bicarbonate is HCO3 negative. So notice that we already have inherently a negative charge on this particular ion, HCO3 negative. And we know that hydrogen ions are H positive when they're all alone. Hydrogen is a 1+, whereas H3O has a 1-. So meaning those two want to combine. That positive and those negative ions, they want to combine and balance each other out. That ends up forming the substance known as H2CO3, which is carbonic acid inside of our bloodstream. Our body is trying to release that bicarb in order to help us balance our pH and return everything back to normal. So remember, on that per hydrogen scale here, on that pH scale, if I have a bunch of hydrogen that's kind of rolling around on the inside of my blood, and then all of a sudden I start robbing away that hydrogen out of my blood and removing that from being a free hydrogen, I'm lowering that pH scale and I'm making myself even more acidic. So my body is constantly producing CO2 as part of the Krebs cycle, or the citric acid cycle, or that aerobic cellular metabolism, that big long cycle that's trying to produce ATP. This means that my body is constantly trying to be acidic. It's constantly falling more towards the acidic side. And therefore my body is now actively working against that by respirating and producing bicarb to try to shift my own pH back towards that alkalinic state. Now, chloride is very important for maintaining fluid volumes in the body, and it plays its own part in homeostasis. But when we come along and we dump saline into the mix, we're going to add a lot of hydrogen and we're going to add a lot of chloride ions that like to interact and further bind up my free bicarbonate that's hanging around there. So now I'm adding in more hydrogen. And yet I'm binding up all of my bicarb in there that is one of my buffers to try to keep me a little bit more on the basic side of that shift. I'm removing that safety net. And after I bind all that stuff up, the only thing that I'm really left with here is I'm actually left with negative chloride ions that are running around. And hydrogen loves to bind with chloride as well. So if there's even more hydrogen that was hanging out in that area, that hydrogen's going to want to bind with that chloride too, which means I'm even further decreasing that pH and I'm moving myself more towards an acidic side. So either way, I want you to take from this, and I want you to understand that when we add saline to someone, we are pushing them acidic. We are lowering their pH, and we're also inhibiting bicarb, which is one of those safety mechanisms that's inside of the blood that they have at their disposal, which helps us fight off acidosis, right? And now we're inhibiting one of those protective mechanisms that our system might need to help us maintain that pH, which means we're almost always now leaning on the other system, which is respiration, our ability to blow off carbonic acid, remove CO2 from our system here by breathing harder, breathing faster, increasing that respiratory rate. So now that we've kind of discussed that, we've discussed those things, let's talk a little bit about why pH matters to clot formation. In the presence of an acidic environment, remember that lower pH, fibrinogen has a harder time becoming fibrin. Right? And fibrin is what we're trying to make in order to make that fibrin mesh. That's that sticky net substance that captures and collects all those things and makes a plug for that broken vessel. But in an acidic environment, fibrinogen has a harder time becoming fibrin. Acidosis compromises thrombin generation. Acidosis severely inhibits the propagation phase of thrombin generation. Acidosis accelerates fibrinogen degradation, leading to a potential deficit in fibrinogen availability. In fact, studies have shown that as the pH of our body approaches 7.0, which is that midline point, remember we're normally about 7.35 to 7.45, and remember we're dumping saline in, which is at 5.5, that clot formation is inhibited by almost 25 to 30%. And on top of that, it can take 20% longer to actually provide homeostasis once it is actually formed because the fibrinogen is being degraded by that acidotic environment. So when we apply this to a situation where I have someone who's bleeding and I need to promote their own clotting cascade to form clots and limit their bleed and try to get hemostasis and homeostasis within that patient, adding too much saline to the mix can now shift their pH and make clot formations harder to occur. Not to mention, tissue that is at or below the level of the bleed will already be starving for oxygen. They're already going to be producing their own lactic acid secondary to anaerobic metabolism. This is going to further worsen the patient's pH in those localized compartments. So it's already fighting this battle before we even add saline to that mix. All right, so not to keep harping on saline for trauma here, but we also have some other inherent problems that occur when we give saline to patients in the field during a traumatic event. The presence of saline is actually going to dilute the concentration of available platelets and activator enzymes in the first place that signal, activate, and collect products to that area to plug the hole. Saline is not an active oxygen transporter, so we have an increasing ineffectiveness of the circulating volume for the amount of saline that we're putting into them. So that circulating volume may not be able to transport as much oxygen and remove as much CO2 from affected tissues. This also might affect pH as well, if those tissues are not actively offloading their CO2 byproducts from the Krebs cycle. Lastly, saline is inherently cold. Despite our best attempts to keep it warm, the saline that we keep in our jump kit, that is icy cold. And even the stuff that we're keeping on our shelves inside of that warmer, once it comes out, it's already actively cooling off with every second that it's spending outside of that warmer. A patient who is injured already struggles to thermoregulate. Now we add a dose of cold saline on top of that cold scene while breathing cold air, removing clothing from the patient, or even if their clothing is saturated with their own wet blood, this patient's body temperature is inherently going to take a nosedive. cold patients have devastating outcomes in the presence of traumatic injuries. One study, 71 trauma patients that were evaluated whose core temperature dropped down to 32 degrees centigrade, which is 89 degrees Fahrenheit, demonstrated a 100% mortality rate at 89 degrees Fahrenheit when associated trauma was there. That means that we're normally here between that 98.5 degrees or maybe a little bit higher than that, and we take a nosedive down towards that 89 degree hard deck, we have an exponential downward curve of worsening survival rates. It means the expectation these patients are gonna do well, for every degree of body temperature that they're losing, they're gonna have exponential increase of worsening survival rates with all of this. But this talk isn't about how saline is the devil. Actually, I just want to arm you guys with information. This talk is about why we need to apply thought and care when we reach into our toolbox and we pull out a tool and we apply it to the problem. Saline has been around, and it does have one great benefit that balances out some of these risk factors. It promotes circulating volume, and it helps in the short term to keep us perfusing until we can get to blood product, till we can get to a surgeon, until we can get to that higher level of care. And in the presence of not having anything else, saline can be better than nothing. This is the key concept behind this topic of permissive hypotension. And understanding everything we've been talking to up until this point, now we're going to start talking about when do we actually apply that saline. So what is permissive hypotension? The concept of permissive hypotension, or allowable hypotension, this refers to managing trauma patients by restricting the amount of resuscitation fluid and maintaining blood pressure in the lower than normal range if there is continuing bleeding during an acute period of injury. And this all comes down to, how do we know if and when their hypotension has reached a point that is too low, or is it still permissively okay to be lower than the normal range from what we're talking about here? So this comes down to, how are we taking blood pressures? We need to take full sets of vitals here, and I'm talking systolic and diastolic blood pressures, because what we need to start putting in the back of our minds, the gold standard behind this, is mean arterial pressure, or MAP scores. Now, MAP scores can be a little scary because we have to apply some math to all of this, but hopefully I have a workaround here that's going to help you guys with that. We calculate the mean arterial pressure in a patient by taking 2 times the diastolic number plus the systolic number, and then divide that whole thing by 3. And what we're really looking for here is, we're hoping to see that that score is somewhere above 60 to 65. Cerebral perfusion pressure, which is the amount of pressure that it takes to be on the very lowest acceptable area of being able to perfuse the brain with every single pump of the heart, is about 60. So when we're really looking at that as being the hard deck on this, if I'm taking that cerebral perfusion pressure and I take 60 and I multiply it by 3, that means that when I take 2 times my diastolic plus my systolic, I need to have a number that's at least 180, if not getting all the way up to that 200 range, to make sure that I have that as the lowest level that I ever want to see that as. So when I'm calculating mean arterial pressures and I'm shooting for a number here in my head, 2 times my diastolic plus my systolic, if that's at 180 or above, I know that I'm within an acceptable range for permissive hypotension. If I'm below that, I might need to start applying some concepts here on wanting to stem the blood loss, improve their perfusion, and probably even apply some saline to that to bump them back up to a mean arterial score that's acceptable, and kind of feather or even titrate the amount of saline that it's going to take to get them to that range, knowing that every time I give them saline, there is a cost to that, and I'm pushing them in a different direction. So, how does this really fit into our trauma scenes? How do I apply this as a provider? First off, it all comes down to the basics. Identify at-risk individuals. This is where our trauma assessments become king. Looking at the mechanism of injury, being hyper-suspicious about what we're dealing with, looking for comorbid factors that raises our level of suspicion or increases that patient's risk factors, things like you know, anticoagulants that they're taking, more at-risk individuals like people who are addicted to alcohol and have a long history of using alcohol, that ends up making them less likely to be able to clot or even more likely to have solid organ injury when it comes to a traumatic event. Remembering that we don't have to see blood on the ground for the patient to be bleeding internally enough to be at risk for their own life, right? That's where identification of those internal organ injuries like liver lax, spleen lax, when we're thinking about injuries to the heart or injuries to the lungs, these are all things we need to identify early. And if we can find the bleed, we need to stop it. So this means that as we're working on this trauma scene, we've identified a bleed. We need to do what we can to stop that bleed, putting direct pressure on that site, raising it up above the level of the heart. So gravity is even helping to stem the blood loss. If that's not working, consider using pressure points to slow that blood loss down enough until we get more definitive treatments applied to that area. Maybe this is something like applying tourniquets to compressible areas, right? In wounds that are bleeding, that have the ability for us to turn off that blood vessel above the area. We're doing that to save the circulating blood volume throughout the rest of their body and to keep every single pump of that heart from losing more of that precious blood onto the ground. A pressure point will help us to even limit that as well. Even down to the application of like hemostatic agents on maybe junctional trauma, areas that involve the groin or the armpits where I have like a major blood vessel there that I can't actively put a tourniquet on, that pressure alone isn't going to be able to stop, using those super thirsty devices like Quick Clot or chitosan bandages, those sorts of things to help dehydrate that area and form a clot on the inside of that area. So once again, we're trying to limit the blood loss on these cases. Now we're really looking at the patient's vital signs, and that's helping us to determine even more so what we do from there. If they are normotensive, great, leave it alone, but we're gonna wanna watch this patient like a hawk. We're gonna wanna start a couple of lines and be ready to infuse fluids, providing even more opportunity when we get to the hospital that they have access to provide blood to that patient, blood products through that patient, as well as having a secondary line that they can push meds and treatments and therapies through that may not play well with the blood product infusion that's going in the other side, right? We're gonna place them on saline locks and not necessarily placing those lines on actively dripping saline. Be ready to administer fluids, but really solidly consider that every time we apply saline to this patient, just like we were talking about here before, we're gonna be pushing that patient more acidotic. We might be interfering with that clotting cascade. There is a consequence to using saline. So just giving them a maintenance bolus because maybe it makes us feel better, maybe we just do that always to TKO, keep that vein open. This isn't the case. This isn't the time to do that. Balance your justification of those therapies with that MAP score. Is my MAP score above 180? If it's so, it's permissively low. I need to take them quickly to someone who has blood product, and I'm going to be watching for that blood pressure to drop all the time. This is also why palpated blood pressures, they're just not quality vitals. We need that secondary number to know how far decompensated has this patient gotten? How much vascular relaxation do we have, or how empty are those blood vessels looking on this patient? We really only get that with a diastolic number. Next thing we wanna do, we're watching this patient, we are limiting our saline, we're trying to titrate it up and down as we might need, warm them up. Even if you are sweating in the back of the ambulance, even if the ambulance is hot, warm them up. Blankets, hot packs, those can all help. Having them breathe in that heated air that's inside of the ambulance is gonna actively start warming that core. We wanna try to stem off any sort of a hypothermic drop with this patient as well, especially if we're bagging them. Bag in that warm air as much as you can. Watch those blood pressures, make sure that we're keeping those numbers up above 180 to 200, right? And if they're not and we're watching those blood pressures fail, start adding saline. Titrate that saline in there until we can get that blood pressure back up. Simultaneously, we should also be double checking any intervention that we've made up until this point. Maybe that tourniquet has slipped. Maybe it actually unwound itself and it became untied, and that tourniquet now is not actively applying that and they're bleeding out again. And maybe that's an early sign that we need to do a re-intervention on that. Maybe even applying a second tourniquet to the area to assist the first one to try to finally pinch off that blood vessel that's there. Maybe your wound packing has opened back up. Maybe that hemostatic dressing that you put in there has moved and cracked and they're absolutely bleeding back out into that compartment or into that area. Reassess those areas. There's even other things that we need to consider here that we might be able to do something about in the field. Medics, I hope that immediately kicked off a light in your head and you're thinking developing pneumothorax on this patient. If we already have significant chest trauma, we think we're dealing with a liver lack or a splenic lack, but our blood pressures are continuing to fail, reassess those lung sounds. Look and see if we have a developing tension pneumothorax. That is something that we can help to fix in the field. Maybe we don't need saline because they're tachycardic and hypotensive. Maybe we actually have pressure being put on the heart, pressure being put on our great vessels, and we're not actually getting any of that blood return back to the heart because we have a tension pneumo. Fix it. If we can do that, our blood pressures come back to normal, fantastic. Limit the amount of saline we're pushing into this patient by looking at some of those other treatments or some of those other therapies we can get. Overall though, we're gonna just titrate that saline to effect. We're gonna try to titrate getting that stuff ready to go and then set that patient up for success. When we walk in the room, we're able to provide a couple of routes of access for this patient. Maybe that's IOs, maybe that's large bore IVs, maybe that's an EJ, something like that. Get that patient ready for blood product and get them ready to be filled back up with that. Now there's one contraindication for patients here with permissive hypotension. And it's a dirty answer, and I don't have a good answer for that in this particular podcast. Maybe this would be something that if you have suggestions, we can start looking at it, or maybe we can research it a little bit and talk to some experts about it. But permissive hypotensive strategies are contraindicated in patients presenting with traumatic brain injury. In such cases, that mean arterial pressure needs to be much higher, and it needs to be greater than 80 in order to be perfusing a brain that is actively swelling, that is actively filling up, or that has a developed amount of pressure inside of that cranial vault, and it's really required to maintain blood flow going to the brain. So when we're thinking about that, we're thinking that we have some sort of a brain insult that's happened here. You know, that mean arterial pressure of 60 is not going to cut it. We need to be at 80 or even a bit above that. And that's going to be even dynamic past that point, that as the increase in intracranial pressure starts to build, my MAP score is something that's going to have to be able to match it in order to be able to move blood into the brain and actually get oxygenated blood to those tissues. Thanks again for listening to this, and I hope this is brushing out some of those cobwebs and getting you thinking about trauma and how we're addressing trauma in the field. Thanks for listening to the Falk Salem Podcast. We welcome any feedback you may have, or if you have suggestions for future content, please send an email to Nicholas, that's N-I-C-H-O-L-A-S, .vaneps, V-A-N-E-P-P-S, @falk.com. Thank you for all your hard work, and have a safe shift.